Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
I think we're using a traditional model.
It's World Trade Organization chief economist Ralph Oso.
We are using one, also aware of its limitations. Being aware of its limitations, being very clear of the assumptions we make, and are very transparent also in the report. And I would say one of the issues that one would need to think about is exactly what I already went into, which is the adjustment in the real exchange rate. Because in practice, of course, there's also a financial system. There's also reactions to nominal exchange rates and so on, as you've seen with the financial market repercussions. So I guess we'll see how this pans out.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This is something that the members themselves have to decide.
Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala is Director General of the World Trade Organization on whether a meeting should be called among members over tariffs.
As you know, WTO is a very interesting organization. It's actually member-driven. So it's the members who have to decide whether they want to have particular meetings or get-togethers or take particular actions. And as we speak, the General Council Chair has been consulting with members to see what they would like to do, whether they would indeed want to go for such a meeting or not. So that is ongoing as we speak. And we will get the results when the General Council Chair has finished his consultations. What I do know is that members are talking to each other in different groups and configurations. And they are trying to... One of the very important things that has come out, as I said in my remarks, is the fact that members now more than ever appreciate the stability and predictability of the multilateral trading system and the WTO, the rules that make this possible for businesses to be able to trade with some predictability. We have calculated that in spite of these tariffs, we still have 74% of world trade under most favored nation terms, and they absolutely want to find ways to maintain that. So I know they are talking to each other. The EU is reaching out to certain groups. New Zealand is reaching out to other groups. Singapore and Switzerland got together a group of friends of the system, and they are all talking about the same thing. How do we collaborate with each other to strengthen and safeguard the rules within the 87% of world trade? U.S. is 13% of world trade, so 87% is going on among other members. And I know they are also talking about how do we strengthen and safeguard that whilst trying to reform those things that don't work within the system. I think you saw my remarks. One of the lessons is that accepting that we need to reposition the WTO, reform it, and redynamize it. And they're also talking about that.
Says the organization moves slow by design.
When I talk about decision-making processes, I'm not saying we walk away. I'm not a member. Remember, I'm the DG. It is members who have to decide how they want to do this. But we also need to admit that the decision-making processes are not getting results as fast as they should. And something, we need to work on this. So it will be up to members. I think everybody treasures the consensus. I'm often proud that this is one organization where the smallest member has the same clout and voice as the largest. But it does result in a slowdown in decision-making, sometimes tie-up in decision-making. When we can deliver something, we don't deliver it as fast as we could. So we need to tackle this and say, how do we refine what we have and make it more workable? That's what I mean. And I think it's one of the reforms we need to look at. But members have to focus on this and decide on it.
And on the idea African countries could be forced to choose sides.
I strongly believe that what I hear from African ministers is they want to pursue a balanced development. I don't think any of them wants to be made to take sides. And since many of them are also small economies, this is of great concern. And that is why I stated my concern about the possibility of fragmentation and polarization of trade in blocks. The countries do not, they want to pursue a balanced approach. That's my answer to that.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Federal Reserve, what was it, a week or so ago, lowered their economic growth projections for the United States for the next 3 years.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert is the chairman of the Joint Economic Council.
Just that lowering. I think they lowered us from like 2.1 to 1.7% this year. That's almost $200 billion of tax receipts in a single year. So just that movement of lowering down economic growth projections is more than we're talking about trying to reduce spending if you take it over 10 years. It's like this place is incapable of understanding the scale of the trouble we're in. And I've tried to show this a couple times. I'm not beating up anyone. I'm just asking people. I desperately want to extend the 2017 tax reform. I was on the committee. I'm one of only four or five people still on Ways and Means that actually helped write the 2017 tax reform. And those portions expire at the end of this year. I believe it's the absolute right thing to extend them. We should just pay for it. Because when we don't pay for it, our base number, now this is, you're going to see two differences here. We're using the next 10 years. So that takes us to 2035. The Senate budget, they did a gimmick. They used 2034. We couldn't figure out why we couldn't get the numbers to match up. They played a game of they only used 9 budget years. We're scheduled to borrow $22 trillion over the next 10 years. If we do all the tax reform but don't do pay for it, that's about, and then add interest on it, that's another 6.8. If you basically then add a number of the president's additional priorities but don't pay for them, don't try to find, you end up at $74 trillion of borrowing in functioning 9 budget years, 10 years. I'm going to show you a couple boards here. If you actually add it up, we're functionally talking about almost doubling what took us 240 years in debt to build up. We're talking about doubling it. Well, close to doubling it. In the next 9 years, have we lost our minds? So this is what some you hear a number of us fussing about. We can't figure out what the Senate was thinking. Well, were they just in avoidance of, we don't want to tell anyone we're going to try to do something. It's not even, shouldn't be that hard. Remember, $86 trillion of spending. The House was just trying to do 2, and I thought 2 is absolutely anemic. We should have covered all 4, 4.5 trillion. One of the hardest votes I made in my decade plus here was standing right there and swallowing, saying, I'm going to vote for this, but I'm really unhappy because we are capable of doing more. And if we don't start to telegraph to the bond markets, we're going to do something serious. At what moment does the bond market say, screw these people? They're just not serious. They're consuming the world's capital. Let's charge them more. Do you really think the United States, with our exorbitant privilege of having the world's reserve currency, being the country that people want to come and do their business in, move to, put their capital in, do you think that's our birthright? Remember, up until World War II, it was Great Britain had the world's reserve currency. We are squandering our place in the world. And people run around saying, well, we need to push down the value of the dollar. So you have trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars around the world that are held by people, and you're going to push down the value of their holdings because, just understand, every time someone says something like that, you can actually start to see the full faith in United States start to taper away. We are about to squander this extraordinary privilege we have because the world trades in our currency. They need to buy our debt because they need to hold our currency because that's what they denominate in, that's what they trade in, that's their peg.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Today I'd like to visit with our dairy producers concerning the increased need to pay attention to what we're doing in the calving area as well as the care for the young calves.
Dr. Mike Brook is a Kansas State dairy specialist.
It is amazing what small dairy calves are worth today. We see that sometimes we can get as much as $900 or $1,000 for a crossbred Holstein beef calf for the feedlot market. And dairy heifers are in short supply, so those heifer calves being born on your farm become increasingly valuable. However, as I review farm records and also visit farms, I see that we're probably missing some opportunities with young calves, considering the death rates that we sometimes see. And a lot of this just simply has to do with paying attention to details and making sure that we are very consistent in the care of the calf soon after birth. One of the biggest things we can do is just simply be present when the calf is born. And I know for smaller farms, this is difficult when you have births that occur overnight when people generally aren't around the farm. However, we have technology such as cameras that we could install to monitor what's going on in the calving area from a distance. It's very, very critical that we still dip those navel cords soon after the calf is born. And please recognize that within about 30 to 60 minutes, that calf will be up and trying to find something to nurse. This is the second area that sometimes when we're not present leads to some health issues for that young calf. They will consume whatever they can get their mouth on, and if that means that there's manure on the bedding, yes, that's what will be ingested rather than colostrum. So feeding colostrum soon after birth is very, very important to the overall health of the calf, and it's important that that colostrum be high quality. Many times we might want to consider a second feeding of colostrum within the first 6 hours after birth if we're not feeding a gallon in the first feeding. This colostrum is important to protect the calf and provide for an immune system for the young calf until it can develop its own a few weeks down the road. Once we get the calf taken care of at birth, it's important that we continue to feed that calf a nutritious diet, making sure that they have an adequate growth rate. It has been shown that the nutrition program during the first 8 weeks of life is very, very important to the overall health of the calf as well as to their rate of growth. And this has significant impacts on their first lactation milk yield. And if we're sending them on to a feedlot later on, again, these same practices are still important for those animals as well, as we want to be shipping growthy calves to the feed yard industry. So making sure that we feed adequate liquid feed, and I would recommend an accelerated growth program where we feed more than the standard amount of milk replacer or waste milk to these animals so we get quicker growth and better health in these animals early on. And the final thing that we would like to address today is the fact that many times after weaning, from weaning till about 6 months of age, we see a depression in growth rates in our calves. This is because we haven't paid careful attention to the nutrition program that they're receiving. We know that calves that are stunted in growth through the first 6 months of life will likely exit our herd sooner and will have lower rates of milk production as a lactating animal.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
On the trade diversion effects, the number for Europe is 6%, so Chinese exports to Europe are projected to increase by 6%.
Ralph Oso is the chief economist at the World Trade Organization.
One thing on trade diversion, I think you have to keep in mind that this is a two-way street in the sense that, of course, there will be some Chinese exports being diverted to Europe, but there will also be some European exports diverted to other economies. Think about the high tariffs that are in place on motor vehicles, for example. And this is, of course, something that will need to be carefully managed because that's a way through which these tensions could potentially propagate beyond U.S. trading relationships.
Says economic projections have been affected.
We have included in our projections, of course, the, maybe not of course, but we have included the fact that what is hampering international trade now are not just the tariffs as such, but also the trade policy uncertainty, because, of course, if you're an exporter, you're not just concerned about the tariffs that are in place today, but also you're concerned about the possibility that tariffs may increase tomorrow. In the projections, in the baseline projections here, are the what we call the adjusted forecast in the numbers that I've been sharing, we limit this trade policy uncertainty to trade relations with the United States. And the scenario that you asked about the spreading of this trade policy uncertainty, that basically means is asking the question, what would happen if this uncertainty spread to other trade relations, and highlights the risk that the Director General was talking about, that what is now confined to, if you will, the 13% of international trade, what if this in some sense spreads? But it's not a spread of tariff it's not an increase of tariffs in the rest of the world. And on Brazil, so we don't do, so I don't have a great answer for you because we don't do projections on individual countries, but I can tell you what we have to say about South America more broadly. So for South America, we project export growth now of 0.6%, which is 0.8 percentage points lower than it would have been without the tariffs. Imports, we project 5.0% growth, 1 percentage point lower than it would have been without the tariff. And GDP, we project an increase by 2.7%. 0.2 percentage points lower than it would have been. And if you look at the effects, basically what you see is you see, well, North America is most affected, Asia is second most affected, and then South America, and that's an issue of geography, of course, because they're close to South America, is not so far from North America, and trade still follows geography.
On challenges.
There's a few things going on. You already mentioned the retaliation, so we're talking about exports now from North America. There's retaliation, but then it's also true that import tariffs have effects on exports as well, which is often not appreciated. One direct effect is that if you impose an import tariff, of course, intermediate goods also become more expensive, which then makes it more costly for your exporting firms also to stay competitive. But then also the resources need to come from somewhere. So if you impose an import tariff and you grow your textile industry, say, whatever industry that may be, the people who are employed in these new industries will also have to come from somewhere, and they will come from elsewhere in the economy, including exporting sectors. And one way in which this happens typically in practice is through an appreciation of the real exchange rate. And that's the difficult part, I think, to project.
This is Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
On, you know, doing those things and you know, kind of carrying that fight forward to do what we need to do to, you know, regain some of that market share that we've seen erode over the last few years.
Sean Wade is with Plains Cotton Growers.
Certainly a lot of that's going to have to do and be influenced by, you know, the broader economic situation, both in the United States and around the globe. But I think, you know, there's certainly a lot of awareness and hopefully an additional focus on, you know, the advantages that cotton brings to the table when it comes to, you know, making those clothing purchases or textile purchases that we do make on a very regular basis as consumers, and encouraging, you know, more people to, you know, kind of just put a little more cotton in the mix there. You know, it's really amazing when you look at some of the numbers that are out there, just reclaiming 2 to 3% of textile market share from the man-made fiber side of the of that ledger, could, you know, easily increase cotton consumption around the world by, you know, 5 to 10%, which is really kind of amazing, and certainly would put you know, maybe producers on a much better path on both price and demand to you know, kind of support higher production opportunities as well.
Nonetheless, the clock is ticking for this next year's crop.
We've gotten through those first two rounds of kind of decision making as far as, you know, programs and safety net options, and, you know, in between those decisions being made, of course, you know, producers have been out doing, you know, a lot of field prep, a lot of field work being done, trying to you know, get this ground in shape and ready to plant. That's entailed, you know, maybe some a little more than expected, maybe some breaking activity in some of our southern areas, especially where, you know, maybe they've had some issues with some blowing sand and dry conditions. But, you know, it's springtime, and we you know, beginning to see a little bit more activity from the weather. Of course, this last weekend, we had, you know, a nice little front that came through, and, you know, we had one of those typical West Texas weekends. They went from 90 to 60 to, you know, snowing all day on the Saturday, and then back to 80 and 90 on Monday and Tuesday again. So it's been kind of an up and down weather pattern, but the good news is that a lot of our counties on the western edge, you know, say Yoakum, Cochran, along that New Mexico state line up and moving north, A lot of those areas were able to receive, you know, anywhere from a half to even 2 to 2.5 inches of you know, rain, snow, maybe combination. So that's been a blessing, especially for those growers that, you know, were just looking for, you know, maybe a little bit of additional help to be ready to plant and get that soil moisture topped off. I think we would still need and still certainly welcome another round or two of storms before we can, you know, before we hit those planter boxes and get those planters running into the fields. But a lot of growers along that same corridor would be, you know, looking to get started with their planting activity maybe as early as May the 1st, especially kind of in the more northern counties in the panhandle. So the weather forecast, you know, looks like it's going to give us some opportunities over the next week to maybe get some showers in here. So that would certainly be good. And we'll just be looking, as we typically are this time of year, to fill in the holes and, you know, fill in some of the gaps where we've got some dry areas. And we certainly do have kind of a mixed bag across the whole area. We've got areas that, you know, still haven't seen much more than a half inch of rainfall total all year long.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The United States and Brazil together supply over 80% of global soybean exports.
Joanna Calusi is a University of Illinois ag economist.
While China accounts for around 60% of total soybean imports. For both the U.S. and Brazil, soybeans are the top agriculture export to China. But with the escalation of global trade tensions following Trump's new tariff announcement, what can we expect for this trade relationship? If you look back to 2017, before the first round of the trade war, Brazil emerged with more exports. Brazil has increased its soybean exports by 45%, from 2.5 billion bushels to 3.6 billion bushels in 2024. Meanwhile, the United States has kept its exports at around 2 billion bushels. In other words, much of the growth in global soybean demand in recent years has been supplied by Brazilian soybeans. In 2018, the first year of the trade war, Brazil's share of soybean exports to China peaked at 82%, while the U.S. share dropped to just 18%. Although China's share of U.S. soybean exports has since recovered to around 50%, it remains below the pre-2018 level of 60%. American soybeans now face double the tariffs in the Chinese market compared to the levels during Trump's first term. And this time, other major trading partners like the European Union are also affected. In fact, all of the top 10 markets for U.S. soybeans have been hit with tariffs. This is no longer just a trade war between China and U.S. It has escalated into a global trade war. According to the American Soybean Association, U.S. soybean farmers could lose around $6 billion annually. Meanwhile, Brazil is expecting a new record for soybean exports, driven by a record harvest over 6 billion bushels and stronger Chinese demand. The Brazilian Association of Vegetable Oil Industry projects soybeans exports will reach 3.9 billion bushels this year. In 2024, China accounted for 73% of Brazil's soybean exports. Brazilian soybeans have also become more attractive to Chinese buyers due to a stronger U.S. dollar, which has made Brazilian soybeans more competitive. In addition, Brazil has improved its logistics, cutting transportation costs and narrowing the gap with the U.S. infrastructure. In fact, Chinese companies are also investing in Brazilian ports, roads, and railways. The tension between the U.S. and China is already pushing up soybean prices in Brazil. Soybean export premiums at Brazilian ports have reached their highest level for this time of the year since 2022, when the Russia-Ukraine conflict began. In March, the additional prices buyers pay over the benchmark surged by around 70%. On April 3rd, one day after Trump's tariff announcement, Brazilian pork premiums hit $1 per bushel above Chicago benchmark prices.
University of Illinois' Joanna Colucci. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today. A look at U.S. meat trade forecast for April points to overall export reductions month over month and year over year. USDA World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekanowski explains why. Starting with
beef export forecasts. The change this month was largely reflecting reduced exports to China because of both tariff and non-tariff barriers, including the fact that we've seen a lapse in plant registrations for exports to China.
Lower pork exports were also driven by less trade with China, as well as
increased global competition in other markets, and that's increased competition from the likes of Brazil and the EU supplying pork into those markets.
Broiler exports were adjusted lower due to strong U.S. prices and stronger export price competition from Brazil. The turkey export forecasts are down from the previous month due to less expected production. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.